The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to CBF Legal this morning. We have Professor Judge with us back today. And we've got a bit of ringing in the microphone that Peter will run over to the speaker and fix. So Professor Judge is back with us today. On page two is a biography of Professor Judge. I think many people here will know Professor Judge well, but I'll just briefly. Receiving his honorary Doctor of Letters from Sydney University in 2006, Emeritus Professor Edwin Judge was described as one of the leading academic figures in modern Australia. He has founded numerous academic journals and research centres and has the Ciceronian ability to arouse and analyse his listeners and readers. He founded the Ancient History Department at Macquarie University, for which he is now Emeritus Professor. He is a historian of culture and inherited traditions. And today's talk is the first of two talks the Professor Judge will be giving, and the series is New Atheism, and today is The Origin of Atheism. Now, our program will be the usual program, so Professor Judge will speak for about 30 minutes or so. We'll have a short break. You'll get the opportunity of scribbling out questions, then answers, and we'll be all done by 8:20. So, Professor Judge, over to you.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad to hear the series is called The New Atheism. I suppose I was told that. But the point I want to make is it's pretty old, really. There are, in fact, sorts of people who were denounced as atheists in the 2nd century AD. One lot was the Epicureans, the secluded philosophical communities that arose. The Epicureans were alleged to be atheists. And the other was the Christians, who were rather more emphatically alleged to be atheists. Oddly enough, the Jews were not often called atheists, even though the Romans were well aware of the curious fact that within the temple at Jerusalem there was no God. So intriguing was this that when the Romans conquered Jerusalem, they did that several times, but in 63 BC, the victorious general Pompey took 3 months to capture, so well fortified was it, with the priests carrying out the rituals of daily sacrifices uninterrupted by the siege and by the arrival of Pompeius in the temple itself, and his determination to go into the Holy of Holies and verify that there was no God there, which he did. Sublimely went on sacrificing as usual, so I'm told. Later on, 100 years later, in the time of Caligula, Caesar, he proposed to put his statue in the temple at Jerusalem that was assassinated before that atrocity could occur. Both the Christians and the Epicureans developed strongly argued refutations and condemnations of the cult of the gods. The argument being, quite simple, they were bogus. The gods, that is the statues and other objects which embodied the gods, were simply a put-up job. Both the Epicureans and the Christians argued this all the time, much to the shock and indignation of the culture in general, which was deeply attached to the cult principle. The term atheist is a Greek word, and it arose by stages, as words do, mean hostile to the gods, or even hateful to the gods, and generally impious. But the modern intellectual position, which we call atheism, developed in the course of philosophical debate amongst the pre-Socratic schools. You've probably got a sheet of paper with the names of some of the pre-Socratic philosophers on them. I've called them fragmentary suspects because they don't survive. That is, their works don't survive. But we know a very great deal about them from endless discussion of them in subsequent writers. The Roman numerals down the left-hand column are the centuries BC. And you'll see under the 4th century BC, Plato and Aristotle, they do survive on the grand scale. And these massive extant 4th century philosophers themselves catch up in backward reference and discussion the views of a couple of dozen highly unusual and enterprising thinkers of the previous centuries, beginning with the great originator Thales in the 6th century. And he was the one who determined that the basic stuff of the universe as a whole was water. Not a bad guess, really. He didn't have a wide choice. The whole of the Greek intellectual tradition started from the axiom that it was either water or earth or air or fire. 4 primary substances. I understand them now are 90-odd. But it was very rational. One can easily see the plausibility of each of those positions, and in turn various presuppositions of these material elements, as they were called, as the cause of everything. The crucial thing is that the cosmos was taken as a totality. It was assumed to be permanent, unchanging, perfect, eternal and good. It is a remarkable phenomenon in human history that a tradition in Ionia, I've put the places where these people were born, by the way, in brackets, but they didn't usually stay where they were born. There was a tremendous amount of going back and forth amongst the Greek states. But the early ones in Ionia were on the eastern shore of the Aegean Sea, and we await really a convincing explanation as to why the enterprise of philosophical analysis should have originated there. Philosophy was an entirely new, purely rational and deliberately rational method of analysing what appeared to be the case, without reference to the gods. Except that Thales, as you can see, held that the world was full of gods. That was, of course, common sense. But it also stated a very important principle which was never lost by the rationalizing philosophers, and that is that divinity also is the substance of the whole. There was no separation between the divine and the cosmos. The gods also consisted of particles of matter, deeply or ultimately refined, of course, and often traceable only to the extreme outskirts of the visible cosmos, but part of it all the same. This was true for reasons of principle. There could not be anything other than the cosmos. It was the sum total of all that it was possible to be, including divinity. And so to say that the world was full of gods was only articulating the principle which they all shared. Now these philosophers, of course, were engaged in spectacular debate with each other, contradicting each other in all sorts of ways, but so far as I'm aware, never deviating from the primary axiom, that is, that everything was material, everything was analysable on rational principles, logic indeed, logos, rationality, was itself the constitutive principle of the material universe. So although they seem to disagree all the time, they work within that circumscribed, to us it seems, a circumscribed framework of axioms. Xenophanes, the next I put on the list, is the first I know of who said it's we who make them look like us. The idea quickly was spotted and developed that if you were people different from us, or if you were animals making gods up, you would make them to look like you. So Xenophanes made this telltale point that we, in some sense, make the picture of the gods, but that is only an interim device, since the pantheistic principle applies as ever. By pantheism, the Greeks meant everything was intrinsically divine, and the divine was there everywhere. But the particular gods we give our shape to. By the 5th century, Tartarus, the first to be condemned and persecuted for atheism, stated, we don't know, and by the way, I call these fragmentary because their works don't survive, I've said that. But there are endless citations, and one picks up these odd phrases from the citations that subsequent writers bring to bear about them. And I presume that man, as the measure of all things, is a kind of implicit diminishment of the divine presence. More drastic, perhaps, and longest lasting, and of the greatest importance for our understanding of modern science, is Democritus. Democritus was the pioneer atomist. Everything consisted of indivisible particles. And their arrangement was random. The whole flow was particles on purely non-principle collided with each other, creating whatever appeared. And yet the whole system was, of course, coherent within that random oscillation, if you like. So these, the emphasis upon man and the emphasis upon randomness, seems implicitly to diminish the importance of the gods. And Diodorus, the next on the list, is the first of whom we know, from remarks in later writers, particularly Cicero, the Roman philosophical historian of the 1st century BC, but we know that he was the one upon whom the label of atheism was first explicitly pinned. That's so far as our records go. And he was condemned for it. Condemned also was Critias, colleague of the famous non-writing philosopher Socrates, and Protagoras. The four of them were all condemned to death by the Athenian democracy. The others avoided it in the usual way by going away and living somewhere else. Socrates was the one who simply stayed and took the hemlock and gave up his life in respect for the democratic principle. Prodicus, in the same century, offered the explanation of the gods as springing from our psychology. This, of course, has great resonance amongst atheism to this day. More striking still, perhaps, is Eudemus, spanning the late 4th, early 3rd century, who tells us in his work, which we don't possess, but other people tell us about it, that he set sail from India, southeast, more or less forever, presumably looking south land, which the Greeks already knew was called the Antipodes, their word. Where's my boss? I've lost my watch, so I don't know what's happening. Anyway, not to worry. Someone will have to stop me. Right. Euhemerus went on this great journey. Whether he reached Australia, I've no idea. But he claims to have arrived at an island where there were pillars. It can't have been Easter Island. I don't think he could have got that far. It may have been an imaginary island, but he made a very important discovery. On these pillars were the names of the gods. And these, of course, were memorial pillars for great men. And so he hit upon a fascinating proposition that this is how they are in fact men who are then treated as divine, as indeed happened, for example, to the Roman Caesars and various others. So it was possible, indeed, you can see that even in Homer, for human beings to bridge the transition to the immortal level. Epicurus, in the same period, was the one who developed the Democritean atomic theory on the grand scale. And in the first century at Rome, we have at last a full-scale and magnificent, a majestic hexameter poem in Latin on the nature of things. And it is deeply moving to this day. It is an attempt to unravel in detail, across book after book, the consequences of atomic science. Evolution, if you like, and every other speculative aspect of the matter of the universe. And although the Epicureans, as I said at the beginning, were treated as atheists, Lucretius begins his poem with a beautiful tribute to Venus, the goddess. And just a literary courtesy. The Epicureans did not intend to deny divinity. The only one who flatly says that altogether there are no such things as God, as far as we know, is Diagoras. I've put there in Latin, opposite Lucretius, the tremendous punchline of his poem. After describing the disaster of Iphigenia in the Greek myth, who was sacrificed by her father as a maiden to death in order that the fleet could sail, Lucretius delivers the final judgment, tantum religio potuit suadere malorum. So great were the evils to which men were led by religion. This is exactly, I think, the ethos of the modern atheists as we're seeing them just this day. All of us admire greatly the intellectual brilliance and poetic majesty of Lucretius' work. And that's his conclusion. Six centuries before Lucretius, and somewhat prior to the beginning of this enterprise in Greece, in Mesopotamia, there was published the book of the prophet Isaiah. And in the magnificent poetic chapters 40 to 66, the so-called second Isaiah, you have a furious and mocking denunciation of idolatry. Isaiah's great prophecy arises from full-blown condemnation of the gods. And he's doing it, of course, in the name of the Lord of Sinai, the creator of the universe, but obliterating as means everything that human beings treat as gods, who are only the products of their own hands, as he demonstrates. Read chapter 44, verses 15 to 20 sometime. And in Banks's book, which I cite at the bottom, I read you his conclusion from examining these prophets, and others, of course, are in it too, but Isaiah is the great one. He says of them this, here, that is in the prophets, for the first time, the possibility of humans creating gods comes to expressions as prior to the Greek assault on the gods as human creations. Even if the emphasis is more on physically manufacturing rather than mentally constructing gods, it implies the latter. Some of the ideas, that is in the prophets, that appear in related modern critiques also begin to be hinted at. For example, how worshipping these gods unconsciously deflects what is essentially human onto what is imaginarily divine. How it leads to less rather than more genuine life and spirituality. And how it results in loss of sanity and humanity. That's Banks's assessment of the atheism of the prophets. That goes back, of course, another six centuries further, to about 1200 BC, if it's the date we should assign to the revelation of Sinai. And you'll remember the appalling scene where Moses is to go up the mountain into the mists, the cloud that concealed the Lord, to receive his law, and the people waiting below could stand it no longer, and melted down their gold and created the golden calf and had a magnificent party. Dawkins, the atheist critic of our day, mocks not the golden calf, admires them for it. He mocks the lonely figure on Mount Sinai, sulking, suffering from sexual jealousy. This, of course, misses totally the deep significance. There's no other divinity in the history of the ancient Near East. And apparently distinctly demarcated. And only was it forbidden to make any image of him. But the law he gave was addressed with extreme searching to the inner life of human beings. Who told you you were naked? Where is your brother? This is the God of Sinai. This is not the law. This is a profound probe of human reality itself, the moral reality, which the law doesn't control. But Sinai does. And the reason, one may assume, is that the Genesis narrative, chapter 1, verse 26, does provide an image of God. The image and likeness of God is man. And a second Adam, says Paul, also appears in human form and also bears the image of God. So it is not only the isolation of Sinai which controls this scene, but the God of the cross as well. And that's why the prophet Isaiah brings his hope in the form of the suffering servant. Nothing could be more realistic in life than the figure, the obscene, monstrous, brutal figure of a man crucified. Nothing more humiliating, but it is real. It happened. It was common practice, as you know. And yet to locate the revelation of God himself to that scene is infinitely real. And that is the reality of the divine presence in our time. I think I should just stop there. There's much more I could have gone on to, but I've lost control of the time and my boss is not telling me to stop.
So why don't we take a break for 2 minutes, scribble out some questions, and then...
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for these questions. I'll just plunge in and see whether I can cover this. Around 640 BC, the pioneer of Judaism, which then promoted. There is much debate about the connection between the two, and I think it's relevant, very relevant. It's Democritus who occupies the center. We're doing some how things stand in our record. Getting on to more slippery questions, is atheism a religion whilst agnosticism is not? Well, agnosticism is indeed the prudent philosophical position, since philosophy sets itself a limited agenda. By definition and mutual agreement in the whole philosophical tradition from 6th century BC down to now, it is a tradition where argument on strictly rational basis and orderly classification and questions of meaning and so on is central. It is so much part of our ordinary discourse that we take that for granted. But everybody knows, the brain scientists will tell you, common sense will tell you, there is much more to life than what can be analysed that way. And so there's much to be said for agnosticism when the matter is not soluble by the strictly intellectual method. As to whether atheism should be called a religion, that also is a slippery matter. Most of these, on what I've told you, apart from Diagoras, you could call all of these people agnostics. Well, not quite agnostics, actually. They all believed in some sense in divinity. But what they were challenging, as with Isaiah, is the absurdity of thinking in an object. As for religion, in antiquity, we mean by religion a cult with a sacrificial process and an objective location in a temple or something like that, that is protective for the community. The function of this in all cultures, even today in church life, for example, where the cultic usage has been incorporated, it is a conservative thing, doing it because it protects your tradition. I'm not sure whether atheism is doing that or not. Religion means something quite different now, however. Because of the unique phenomenon of Judeo-Christianity, but Christianity in particular, it's unique to Christianity because the Christians were not a nation. And the Romans could cope well with. They admired the Jewish tradition. They fought three wars with the Jews and banned their own citizens from taking circumcision, for example. But they respect Jews for a striking reason. The philosopher Seneca tells us the Jews know why they do their things. The Romans, of course, did not know. They could. The classic position in all cultic culture, the thing is a given, and you can't explain it. It's not rational. But the Christian phenomenon is a purely rational thing in terms of cultural history. When I say purely, I mean argumentation is the driving force of it. It is like a philosophical movement in that respect, and deeply irritating to people at all times for that reason. But nowadays, of course, we mean by religion the combination of those two things. It's an incoherent combination, self-contradictory, if you like. Either you're going to live by the philosophical method, or you're going to live by the conservative cultic method. But the churches, of course, hopelessly combine them both. And so we now mean by religion the Christian phenomenon in cultural terms, which we now wish onto other cultures. India, for example, in the unhappy plight, having been anglicized half, of having to discover it has a religion, or religions and so on, an idea which would not have occurred before Christianization. Does Islam benefit from having no image of God? Well, it inherits that, of course, from Sinai. But what it does not inherit is the cross. It denies the reality of the cross. Jesus did not die. So, yes, it benefits from strict monotheism. But there is something appallingly rigid, so it seems, I think, to non-Islamic people, about the bind which Islam places upon the culture as a whole. Its extreme prescriptiveness and so on, so that the what appears like the mechanical conformity to the prescription is the essence of the movement. The human dimension, the human reality, so it seems for an outsider at any rate, is what Islam lost. Islam, of course, began as a heresy of Christianity and of Judaism. Next question. Was ancient dualism a way of disconnecting the divine from the earthly and thereby marginalizing the gods? Has modern dualism also separated the spiritual from the temporal in a manner to achieve the same? Yes, I think I agree with that. Next question. Did Cicero condemn atheism or just record that Diodorus was condemned for atheism? Cicero wrote a 3-volume work, which we have, on the nature of the gods. The same topic, on the nature of things, was Lucretius's poem, not of the gods, but things, of which gods were a part. Cicero wrote on the nature of the gods, and it's a dialogue. And in it are set out the views of the Epicureans and the views of the Stoics. And Cicero doesn't say which he follows, but the general opinion of Cicero is that he would classify himself and being classified as an academic, that is, in the Platonic school, and his position would not have been to condemn atheism. Cicero, I think, was more sympathetic to Stoicism, which more actively affirmed the gods than Epicureanism, for example. So I certainly don't think Cicero, well, he was certainly not an atheist. He was also skeptical, however, about the Celtic system. He is a classic representative of the Greco-Roman philosophical tradition, as I've tried to define it. What would I say to persuade Richard Dawkins that atheism is wrong? Read the Bible. Something else would have to be added, of course. But the shallow reading and the... I mean, to read the book of Exodus and treat it like that is postmodernism with a vengeance, really, where you just take it upon yourself to sling your views around an ancient text as though the meaning and function of it and the intention of the writers and all that is just ignored. So you're not listening to it, you're not engaging with the text. This is the great disease of our culture, of course, in which these atheists are reveling. And so what would I say to him? I mean by... it's very hard, of course, for a modern reader to read the Book of Exodus as a credible historical treatment. Everybody can see the problem. But that's not the way to approach it. Of course it's a historical statement, but its manner of formulating the issues and presenting them and so on is distinctive of its epoch. That has been demonstrated. It belongs to the second millennium and the modes of communication that applied then. And this has been amply studied. And there's a very interesting collection of studies produced in this city in the year 2008, from which I've partly been quoting here, an article by Greg Clark, the literary historian of our city. I forget the title of the book, but it's on the Book of Exodus. And I think that Dawkins and friends would do well to read a modern study of the book rather than just jump into their own conclusions. They've just jumped into the deep end and don't know where they are. Next question. If we are satisfied that God created the universe, how do we know that he has not died or departed? The question goes on. If we assume God is eternal, how do we know he is eternally interested? Well, the world is not eternal. I think everybody now agrees with that. Only in the last two decades has it been finally settled by the physicists, as far as I know. And that is the heritage of the Book of Genesis, of course, which was the great place in antiquity where the non-eternity of the world was maintained. And it was maintained because it accepted the God who was totally outside the universe. The universe was his artifact. So I think I'm an agnostic really about whether God is eternally interested. We really need another session on that. So if we're satisfied that God created humans, how do we know that he had not died or departed? Well, we'll deal with that next time. I know you're trying to stop me. Please re-explain how God addressing who told you you are naked and where is your brother. Those are the things in Genesis 3. You'll see the question, who told you are naked? Who told you you are naked? Look it up and see. And in Genesis 4, you'll find the question, where is your brother? These go to the very heart of human experience, culture, history, and everything. And there they are at the very beginning in that book. How is this start of morality when Zeus addressed humans? Well, he didn't really. So it's not like that with Zeus. Zeus was a kind of human being. I mean, he had women, for example, and offspring, including children with mortal girls and this kind of thing. But Zeus is all too human, really. I think I'll stop there. Sorry to go on.
No, that's right. Thanks very much, Professor.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.